From Texas to Ohio, Hawaii to Kentucky, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, nuclear power is both dependable and produces no CO2, but radiophobia is preventing its widespread use. James Broll of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to discuss. The marriage rate and the rate of new household formations is down. What are the economic conditions contributing to this trend? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Are the rich actually paying their fair share of taxes? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has the surprising answer. And the latest edition of Rich States, Poor States is out. Utah, Idaho, and Arizona top the list of states with the best free market tax policies. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Nuclear power is dependable, relatively inexpensive to generate, and the process produces no CO2. Fear of nuclear power plants is based more in popular culture than in scientific fact. James Burrell is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he joins us now to discuss the phenomenon. James, welcome to American Radio Journal. James, when we talk about nuclear power, a lot of folks have a phobia about it, radiophobia, as your article terms it. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But before we do, what is the prevalence of nuclear power in the United States and around the world at the moment? What does it contribute to our electric grid?
I think it's about 10% of the world's electricity. About 18% of U.S. electricity generation comes from nuclear power. When you can compare that to about 60% comes from fossil fuels in the U.S. and 21% from renewables, roughly equivalent to renewables.
You point out in your article, which we're going to talk more about here shortly, that nuclear power has the ability to not only meet our energy needs, but do it simultaneously with reducing carbon emissions. Could you elaborate a bit on that? And if that's the case, why don't we do it?
And it was certainly the case that in the mid-20th century, I think the vision for power in the United States was that we would be mostly powered by nuclear power. It's, as you mentioned, it's one of the only energy sources that doesn't produce any significant carbon dioxide emissions, but is also affordable and reliable. So it doesn't suffer any of the intermediacy problems that renewables do for having only being able to produce when it's sunny or when the wind is blowing. But the reality is there's a lot of fear of radiation in our popular culture. There's Godzilla movies, Three-Eyed Fish from The Simpsons, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There's this fear that it's going to lead to birth defects, which there's actually no evidence that radiation exposure leads to birth defects in humans. But nevertheless, we have all these fears in popular culture. And it turns out that some of this fear comes from the science of how we study radiation.
Talk a little bit more about radiation and your article, Myths and Facts in Radiation Risks, A Simple Solution to Remove Obstacles to Nuclear Power. You'll tell us a little bit later where folks can read that. Talk a bit more about radiation and the term radiophobia. It is a common term, but not one that I would venture to say most people have heard of before.
It's certainly the case that high doses of radiation are bad for you. If a nuclear bomb goes off in your city and the explosion doesn't kill you, then the high doses of radiation that occur certainly can kill people and can cause cancer deaths in particular. But much less is known about what occurs at low doses of radiation that we're exposed to really in our everyday lives. There's sources of radiation coming from within your own body. If you live at a high altitude, like in Denver, Colorado, you can receive pretty significant doses of radiation over the course of your life, or if you take a CAT scan. And so it turns out that there was kind of a change in the scientific model that was used, how human beings will react in terms of cancer from low dose exposure to radiation. And it turns out that a lot of the modeling assumptions that go into these human health risk assessments turn out not really to be based on science, and they conflict with the basic evidence we have where, if you look around the world, where people are exposed to fairly high doses of relative radiation just in their everyday lives. But it's actually grounded in this more of this precautionary mindset.
When we take a look at the impact of public policy then on the development of nuclear energy, James, could you tell us a bit about the role of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and are the policies they are following actually really preventing the further development of nuclear energy?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission uses the kind of modeling assumptions that I'm talking about, and they admit that what they're doing is it's a policy choice. It's not a scientific choice. They use models of radiation risk that assume that even at very low doses of exposure to radiation, that there's a risk of cancer associated with that. And they say that they're doing that because it's a more conservative approach, or kind of better safe than sorry might be the way you would think about it. And so this leads to increased regulatory costs. It leads to, you know, considerable costs in building nuclear power plants and putting up safety protection and reducing that the amount of radiation that workers could be exposed to, or the public who might live near nuclear power plants. And that sounds great. It sounds good in theory, right? Better safe than sorry. Except the fact is the costs become so high that it puts nuclear at a disadvantage relative to other energy sources like fossil fuels, and it leads to a fear that radiation is causing harm when there actually isn't evidence that people are being, that there's an increase in cancer deaths associated with this.
There is the development of these small modular reactors as an alternative to the larger plants. What is a small modular reactor?
These are nuclear power sources. You can think of, in a sense, we've had small modular reactors for a while. They power nuclear submarines. And the idea is that we'll bring more of these on, and they don't produce as much power as a traditional nuclear power plant that we've kind of recognized as from, you know, the 1960s, 70s, when most of the plants were built in the United States. But they're safer, they're smaller. The new technologies are not prone to meltdowns. And even if something were to go wrong, they're just, because of their size, there's considerable less risk associated with them. And so there's been great innovation in this area, and there's attempts in Congress right now to try to speed up permitting of these small modular reactors to bring more of them online. Especially, it can be especially useful in rural areas where you could have a single building or community powered by a smaller reactor like this. But even so, we haven't had many of these approved in the last few years. And there was a project in Idaho, I believe it was, just recently. They were planning to bring on some of these, and the costs were just getting too excessive, and they pulled back.
We have been talking about nuclear powers, and specifically talking about myths and facts when it comes to radiation risks, that a research paper written by James Broll of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where he is a senior fellow. James, tell us a little bit about the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
Competitive Enterprise Institute is a free market libertarian think tank located in Washington, D.C. You can go to cei.org and search for radiation risk, and my paper should come up. My name's James Broll, B-R-O-U-G-H-E-L. You can find me at James Broll on Twitter.
James Broll of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. James, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, on the road, but calling in to talk about a number of issues, especially recent reports that household formation among younger individuals is down, marriage rates are down. We're going to explore why that is the case. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
What is driving the fact that among younger demographics, we are seeing marriage rates stalling out and we're seeing a lack of new household formation?
Well, I think that there's a lot of factors that play into this. You know, one of them is that there aren't a lot of great jobs out there that are providing men with the ability to lead a household. And so when women look for a partner, somebody to settle down with for the rest of their lives, they're not seeing a whole lot of attractive options. So that is why rates are down. And ultimately, part of why salaries are down for men and women in their 30s is this dominance from wealthier individuals that are nearing retirement age right now. You know, there was a saying from Ronald Reagan that freedom is always one generation away from extinction. And I think that economic freedom right now is on the cusp of being extinct. And we've got this tax and regulatory regime from the radical left that continues to crush household formation and job creation, whether it's on the regulatory side or the tax side. We still have marriage penalties all throughout the federal code. Those are things that I think we can address with smarter policies and really embracing what the family unit is, the traditional family unit of a man and woman having children and being a part of society and being self-sufficient contributors into our economy.
If we look at the overall economy here, Scott, gross domestic product, or GDP, is one of the key measures of how well the economy is doing. We had some numbers come out this past week. Didn't quite live up to expectations, did they?
Not quite. We're at about 1.6% right now, which is far behind inflation, which is 3.5%. So the Federal Reserve at, I think, next week's meeting is going to probably take more of like a hawkish approach here. I would expect that these economic numbers don't provide a whole lot of certainty or excitement for those that are trying to get ahead. And a lot of this is borne by the inflationary woes with our energy policies. Right now, gasoline is still soaring. I think everybody's seen the price at the pump increase by 30 to 40 cents over the last 3 weeks. Those are real indicators, I think, of the health of the economy. And if you take out federal spending with GDP, because federal spending is one of the big components when you make that calculation, the health of the private sector economy is very, very weak. And the Biden administration wants to try to manipulate data and say, well, here's what's happening in this area, or here's what's happening here. But the bottom line is that we have basically a crony capitalist system that is pushing us towards socialism, quite honestly, because the Democrats want to tax the wealth. They want to redistribute, and they do that through federal spending, not through actual wage growth, not through the macroeconomic effects that lead to a healthy economy, especially one that we experienced in about 2019 prior to COVID. We need people that are willing to be entrepreneurs and new job creators all throughout America. And I'm talking about from California to New York to rural America, people that are willing to take those innovations that they've been dreaming up and get away from the $60,000 a year job behind a computer, but actually start a new business in their basement or start a new business in their garage. But these kinds of jobs just aren't being produced right now. Instead, people are heavily dependent upon the federal government with government contracts and Small Business Administration loans. And I think that that is leading to a situation here where we're going to be stuck in the 1.6 to 1.4 levels of GDP growth, and we're going to be stuck with higher inflation that really does not seem to be tamed at all. We're certainly not at the 9.1% that we were at just under 2 years ago, but it's still way, way above the target inflation benchmark of 2% that the Federal Reserve sets out. And when you think about the level of growth in the economy, when you are growing, you're creating more taxpayers, you're creating more revenue the old-fashioned way, not through higher tax rates, but through additional growth in revenues. Instead, this week, we've seen Joe Biden really take a hammer to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, those 2017 Trump tax cuts, saying that he wants to allow all of them to expire, which would ultimately result in the largest tax increase in our nation's history.
How hard is it, Scott, to, we talked about household formation, but in terms of an entrepreneur trying to expand or even more difficult, start a business, when you look at the uncertainty that you have here with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you look at all the federal regulations and state regulations, is all this really putting a damper on the entrepreneurial spirit, particularly of young Americans?
I think it is, and there's a few solutions that we could make. When I think about tax policy in particular, right, one big thing from the Trump tax cuts was that we allowed for full expensing of all capital expenditures. And that's really a big sugar rush into entrepreneurs and job creators that are looking to grow or invest in a new business. When you think about the idea of being able to write off all of your expenses related to structures or equipment or land. That's a big, big thing that helps a lot of people that are looking to grow. And if people have access to capital, I think that there's certainly a risk in today's economy, but the reward could be high for those that are able to capitalize on really the lack of investment generally across America.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club. Also, where can we find you on the web?
First of all, the website is clubforgrowth.org. Everybody can sign up and become a member for free. The Club for Growth is the premier free market economic conservative organization in America. You can also check out which candidates Club for Growth PAC is supporting all throughout America in these big races headed into 2024.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Always good to have you with us, Scott. Thank you.
You're welcome.
President Biden is campaigning on making the rich pay their fair share of taxes. But an analysis of income tax collections shows high-income earners already shoulder an outsized share of the burden. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
So tax day came and went more than a week ago, probably close to 2 weeks ago by the time you're listening to this. But man, I'm still just a little bit frustrated about it, as I always am this time of year. And I know we talked about this topic, talked about the federal tax code on last week's program, but I think it's just something. But there's another issue here that has been getting some attention this year, this April 15th tax season. And I think it's worth taking some time to talk about today. So that's what we're going to do. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me today. Instead, we're going to take a look at what I call the real tax gap. And I have a piece at Reason.com from about a week ago looking at this exact topic, the real tax gap. Now in tax policy circles, the phrase tax gap is used to talk about the difference between how much money the IRS thinks it should collect in a given year and how much it actually does. And there's always a little bit of a difference there because of, you know, some people either cheat and don't pay their taxes, some people just underpay their taxes, often through no fault of their own. There's always a little bit of a gap, and the IRS spends a lot of time thinking about how to close the tax gap, how to make sure that they get more of the revenue that they are supposed to get. And this is an issue of tax fairness, and okay, sure, everybody should pay the taxes that are owed, but not a cent more. But I think that's somewhat of a misnomer, because the real tax gap in America is the difference between what Americans think about the tax code. I should say who Americans think are paying federal taxes and who actually is. And that persistent gap between what Americans think, including, by the way, the American who currently occupies the White House, the gap between what those people think about the federal tax code and the reality of who shoulders most of the burden is an actual problem when it comes to policymaking, because it muddles the debate over how to address chronic budget deficits, how to best manage the insolvency of programs like Social Security and Medicare. More generally, it contributes, I think, to a phony sense of class warfare that boosts populist politicians, mostly on the left, but a little bit on the right, too. And President Joe Biden, who historically has been more of a centrist, he's leaned harder into this message, into trying to promote this false message about who pays most of the federal tax burden since he's become president. A common refrain in Biden's speeches has been this claim that American billionaires pay an average tax rate of just 8%. He said it in the State of the Union address, and he says it in many of his stump speeches. It's a claim that the Washington Post actually thoroughly debunked earlier this year. You should look up that piece by Glenn Kessler for sure. But there's also more generic claims, like another promise that Biden made in last month's State of the Union address when he said that he would protect and strengthen Social Security by making the wealthy pay their fair share. Now, polls bear out a similar point of view among the rest of us. A recent Morning Consult and Bloomberg poll of voters in seven swing states found that 69% of people support raising taxes on Americans who earn more than $400,000 annually. Meanwhile, there was a similar poll from the Pew Research Center conducted last year that found 82% of Americans are bothered some or a lot by the feeling that the wealthy are not paying their fair share in federal taxes. The feeling. I mean, not that they actually know, they just feel like that's the case. Now, other surveys show that many Americans don't actually know much about the tax code at all. There was a really interesting survey conducted this year by the Tax Foundation that found that most Americans are not just unhappy with the current tax code, but do not understand it. One commonly misunderstood aspect is how much the wealthiest Americans pay every year. In this Tax Foundation survey, 78% of respondents did not know the share of taxes that are paid by the wealthiest 1% of Americans. But, and I think this is particularly telling, 65% of respondents said their own taxes were too high. So the most straightforward conclusion here is hardly a surprising one. Americans want somebody else, preferably somebody richer, to pay for the cost of the government services that we consume. And here's the good news, I guess. That's already happening. The top 1% of earners, defined as those people who make incomes of more than $682,000 annually, paid 46% of all income taxes in 2021, which is the most recent year that we have complete data for. Now, that's according to some data that was crunched by the National Taxpayers Union Foundation and released last month. Now, that number, again, it's worth repeating. The top 1% of earners paid 46% of all federal income taxes in 2021. And that is the highest percentage of taxes paid by the top 1% in any year since at least 1980. That's as far back as the National Taxpayers Union Foundation survey went. Other wealthier Americans are also contributing heavily. The top 10% of earners bore responsibility for 76% of all income taxes paid, and the top 25% paid 89% of all income taxes, again, according to the NTUF report. Meanwhile, the bottom 50% of taxpayers, the bottom half, paid just 2.3%. of all federal income taxes in 2021. The gap between the perception and reality of how the federal tax code works and who pays for it has important implications for some big decisions that federal policymakers will have to make in the near future. The first of those big decisions will hit next year when many of the provisions of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act expire. Among other things, Congress and the winner of this year's presidential election will have to decide whether to let the personal income tax rates climb back to where they were before the Trump tax cuts in 2017. There's also, of course, the looming question of Social Security's insolvency and how to deal with that. Tax increases will probably be part of that solution at some point. And, you know, none of these decisions will be free from painful trade-offs. But without a better understanding of the burdens of the current tax code, many Americans will be unable to appreciate those trade-offs. And demagoguery about taxing the rich might produce a political payoff in the short term. But it's created a political culture that's less well-equipped to tackle some of these serious questions about fiscal policy and about who should be paying what to cover the annual cost of our $7 trillion federal government. The wealthy are already paying record levels of federal taxes. How much more will be enough? For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of fiscal policy and everything else happening in politics in D.C. and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The annual Rich States, Poor States ranking of state economic policies is out. And Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
All new, just in time for Tax Day 2024, the 17th edition of Rich States, Poor States, the Alec Laffer State Economic Competitive Index went live. The report that I co-author with Dr. Arthur Laffer and Steve Moore uses data on the 15 essential economic policy variables that measure the competitiveness and the economic outlook for the 50 states. Since we launched the project back in 2007, this report has documented states that cut taxes, reduce burdensome regulations, and craft taxpayer-focused budgets attract more residents and jobs. But one thing that has not changed since the start of this project is that Utah has taken the top spot in the economic outlook rankings once again, a position it's earned through years of consistent and innovative free market policy improvements. In 2007, the state took the historic step of implementing a flat tax, which was a huge improvement to the fairness and efficiency of the personal income tax. Utah's pioneering truth in taxation policy has helped keep the property taxes in check for state taxpayers. And most recently, the cuts to the flat income tax have helped keep the Beehive State out in front. In the 2024 legislative session, which just concluded in Salt Lake City, lawmakers cut the personal and corporate income tax rates for the third year in a row. But these latest Rich States, Poor States rankings show that Idaho comes in at second and Arizona at third, Both of these states have been improving for years and are coming close to catching Utah potentially for the number one ranking. These states have adopted policies like right to work and small and efficient state government, along with regulatory reform, that have really led the way. Idaho and Arizona were part of the recent flat tax revolution in 2022 and ditched their outdated, burdensome, graduated progressive income taxes for simplified flat taxes. Arizona in particular is very competitive since its 2.5% flat tax is the lowest rate of any flat tax in the country. Of course, there are some states which levy no income taxes at all, and rich states, poor states also ranks them as some of the most competitive in the nation. In this new edition, Texas, which is one of those states that avoids an income tax, saw one of the biggest improvements from last year. The Lone Star State reached its all-time high ranking of sixth best in the new report. The lack of a personal income tax and other pro-growth policies have made it one of the fastest growing states in America, and landmark $18 billion net tax cuts in 2023 boosted its economic outlook even higher. It should come as no surprise that California and New York bring up the rear of rich states, poor states economic outlook rankings. California ranks 47th, and New York has been ranked dead last for 11 years in a row. The big government policies driving these poor rankings are driving multitudes of hardworking taxpayers out as well. In 2023 alone, New York lost about 217,000 and California lost 338,000 people to domestic outmigration to one of the other states. These states have some of the highest taxes in America, most progressive income taxes, and countless other policies stifling growth and driving individuals and businesses away. Most recently, a $20 an hour minimum wage specifically for fast food workers took effect in California. Already, residents of the Golden State are bearing the burden of higher prices and fast food restaurants are reducing staffing. On top of this, California faces an absolutely shocking $73 billion budget deficit. It should also come as no surprise that the biggest winners from Americans voting with their feet have been at the states that have embraced pro-growth economic policy and ranking well in rich states, poor states. Americans have flocked to the two largest no-income tax states, Florida and Texas, leading to economic growth, job creation, and strong state revenues in both cases. Since 2020, nearly 1.5 million Americans have moved into these two states on net. What an incredible demonstration of the fact that Americans vote with their feet and vote strongly in favor of states that embrace economic opportunity and more freedom. In the laboratories of democracy, the key policies that determine the rich states, poor states index make a difference in economic performance and growth. Americans continue to look for these opportunities to enhance their standard of living across state lines, seeking the states that provide the greatest opportunity and prosperity. And as the rankings have shown now for 17 years in a row, prosperity and growth come in states that embrace low taxes, free markets, and limited government. For more information and to see how your state ranks in rich states, poor states, please visit richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KRCK-FM in Palm Springs, California, KREV-FM in San Francisco, California, along with WIYQ-AM and FM in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.